Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Ian Brown is an author, an editor, an anchor on Canadian TV, and an award-winning journalist. In other words, the man knows how to tell a story. So when he put pen to paper about his own disabled son, Walker, the result was one very moving piece of writing. The book is titled The Boy in the Moon, and it opens a window into the world of a family dealing with orphan syndrome. It's a genetic mutation that causes both mental and physical delay. Only about 100 people in the world have it. 12-year-old Walker can't speak, he can't eat properly, he isn't toilet trained, and has to wear arm cuffs to stop him from hurting himself. Ian's story has revealed both the joy but also the great suffering of a parent searching for the meaning of it all, and he's on the line now from Brisbane. Ian, welcome to Open House. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Walker is 12 years old now. Just when did you discover that he did have these difficulties?
He's actually 14 now, since the book actually came out.
Okay.
But we discovered he had this rare syndrome, which is, technically it's called CFC syndrome, which stands, it's just a mash of symptoms, cardio for the enlarged heart that often goes with it, facio, which is for his facial dysmorphia, and cutaneous, because the skin of these children tends to be dry. For a long time, that they didn't know much about it, and they just threw together a bunch of symptoms. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know Walker had CFC until he was two, which was when we got our first clinical diagnosis. But we knew something was wrong well before that. He was born 5 weeks premature, and he had trouble breathing. He couldn't swallow, so he had a very hard time gaining any weight. He came very close to perishing because of that. We didn't know whether how well he could see or hear, because he seemed to have trouble connecting, and he had these strange spells where he seemed to stare at his hand as if he didn't quite know what was attached to him and what wasn't. Those are the earliest signs.
Just describe the practical day-to-day challenges then of actually parenting Walker. You go into the book. I mean, you really can have some very, very difficult days indeed.
Yes, that too took some time to understand, because when Walker was born, there were only 8 known cases in the scientific literature. And as I say, it took us a long time to figure out what he had. And that's common to the diagnosis of it. Because he can't speak, he can't say what's wrong with him. And clearly something was. He never slept through the night. He would wake up crying and in pain. As a result, my wife and I took alternate nights with him. So neither one of us had 2 consecutive nights of sleep for about, I don't know, about 10 years, I guess. And that can take a toll on you. At about 2, he began to hit himself with increasing severity. He's functionally autistic, although the actual diagnosis is not autism, but functionally he's quite autistic, and you know, will really pound himself to a pulp if you give him half a chance. Mm. He has the mind probably of a 2-year-old, and probably always will. I mean, he's 14 now. He looks about 7, but as I say, mentally, I doubt he'll get much beyond 2.5.
Yeah. And that's self-hitting. Have you tried to work out what might be going on there? Is it just kind of a muscle spasm? Is it something deeper?
Well, it's very hard to say. I mean, and nobody really knows. The doctors who, you know, were learning as we were learning, and in fact we knew more than they did. I mean, they would diagnose ear infection, and we would say, no, it's not ear infection. No, he doesn't cry like that when he has an ear infection. I mean, they couldn't be expected to know more than we did, but the fact that they didn't know more than we did was very characteristic. You know, I mean, it's almost like a new species of human being in a way, that these are people who 20 years ago would have died, 30 years ago would have died, but these remarkable advances in medical technology, you know, keep them alive, get them to the point where they're self-sustaining, but or almost self-sustaining. The problem is that while the medical profession can save their lives, the medical profession has no idea how to keep them and care for them on a day-to-day basis, and that's left up to the parents. So it really, everything's a bit of a guessing game, including the hitting. I have, and doctors have, speculated that it is a desire to stimulate himself, a desire to knock some sort of mini seizure back into place, a desire, my own personal theory that he becomes frustrated, that he's certainly, obviously knows that he's not as capable as other people. As a result of that, I think he sometimes becomes angry and upset and hits himself, which in turn doesn't solve the problem and makes him more upset.
Yeah.
And one of the most, I still, really can't talk about it all that much or very, very clearly, as is probably evident, but he used to hit himself in frustration, and then when he hit himself and hurt himself and it didn't solve it, he'd become even more upset and hit himself again. It became, I personally couldn't even watch it, and so I developed these elaborate systems of restraining him. Even when he was, going to sleep, you'd have to sleep with one arm around his head to hold his left hand, and his right hand in my right hand, and then my leg over his right leg, because if you held his hands, he'd kick himself. So it really was a bit of a contortionist nightmare.
Yes. Ian Brown is the author of this book, The Boy in the Moon. It's about his 14-year-old son, Walker, who has orphan syndrome, a very, very rare syndrome. Only about 100 people in the world have it. Just hearing about the lessons and just at the moment, just simply what it's like to live in that kind of family environment. I know a number of you will be touched by this story and indeed may well have your own stories of living and raising a child with some sort of disability. 1-300-40-2020 is my number. Communication is a big theme throughout the book because, in fact, to some degree, you're not even too sure to what degree he's trying to communicate to you or anything.
No, that's a problem. And, it's not a book of complaints. I mean, as one CFC parent said to me once, there's no point in complaining. You just do what you have to do. And there are these moments, it's very hard to overestimate the difficulty of raising a kid with profound, complex, multiple disabilities. But it's also very rarely does anybody ever describe the sort of intense joy that can come out of it as well. It was as difficult to figure out what his sadness was as it was to figure out what his happiness was. Because, when he's happy, every time he's happy, he's never happier than he is in that moment. And he really does live very much in the continuous, in the moment and in the continuous present. And that's a much tougher thing to do than we realize. And he's a very tough little boy, and he has, I think, very deep feelings. I mean, that's obvious. You can see how deep his pain is or how intense his joy is. The challenge was, for me, A, figuring out what it was he was thinking or feeling or experiencing. But more importantly, even harder than figuring out how to keep him alive, for me, was figuring out the value of a life like his, one that's lived sort of on the periphery and in the semi darkness, I suppose, and that took a long time, and it took a particularly long time in my case because, I'm your standard driven, I would say North American, but I Australians seem pretty much like Canadians.
Very much so.
I'm not an A-type, probably, but I'm pretty close to it, and driven. I measure success against measure success against a very clear, objective scale, money, accomplishment, education, learning, desire to learn, et cetera, et cetera. And it took me a long time to realize that the way to understand Walker. Now, I spent his life trying to make him like me, the way we normally approach disabled people. We want to solve their problems. We want to help them. We want to at least eliminate the problem because it makes us feel so terrible or it frightens us so much, The trick I eventually began to realize was not to make him like me, to make myself more like him. Instead of trying to make him live in my world, to try and occupy his For instance, you know, one of the things he does to this day, for instance, I mean, he's a very charming guy, you know, and he has a way of making you feel things. Mm-hmm. And so if he were here right now and I were talking to you, even on the phone, I'd be watching him steadily because, he can do a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. So, and he would want to, I've got a cup of coffee here, and he would want to come up and clear off my desk, just clear it off onto the floor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'd watch and I'd watch and I'd watch him. But at some point or another, my attention would get distracted by, say, the beautiful day in Brisbane, or, you know, the mountains I can see in the distance. And at that point, he would take my coffee and sweep it off onto the floor. And then he would laugh maniacally. Mm-hmm. And I used to think, you know, he's a psychopath. I mean, at 15, he's going to be in the penitentiary, and I'm going to be visiting him mm-hmm. on weekends and tapping on the glass. But I realized eventually, after I'd watched him do it a couple of hundred times, after I began to slow down and actually watch him, that what he was doing, I was saying, you know, Dad, I know I'm not like you. I'm not as capable as you. But once in a while, I'm as smart as you, because once in a while I can trick you and I can clear your coffee
uh-huh,
off.
Uh-huh. Yes, yeah.
And I think he has this desperate desire to belong, to be equal. And it's a great liberation, I think, for him, you know, to be able to say, I'm like my dad, at least in this way, or mm-hmm. I'm as smart as my dad in at least this way. But as much as it's a liberation for him, it's an enormous liberation for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it makes us equal. Not him my equal. It makes me his equal. And that makes approaching this world of disability much more interesting and much less daunting. To this day, I mean, I spend a lot of time around quite severely disabled children. To this day, when I walk into a room full of them, you know, with their twisted bodies and their, you know, squawking and beeping voices, you know, and their cries and laughs, and you know, it's, I go in and I think, it's like walking into some version of Dante's Inferno. You know, I don't know what to do. I don't know who to help. I don't know where to go first. I don't know how to fix it. It terrifies me, etc. But I've learned that I don't have to defeat that fear, because I can't. Because Walker doesn't expect me to.
Mm-hmm.
He just wants me to be there and be his friend.
Yeah. You've now moved Walker out of your home and into a community home. Just explain just the step, and I guess it must have been a difficult step for you and your wife to actually to take as well, and just the difference that has actually made for everyone, especially him.
Yeah, it took me, I guess, 9 years to find a place that had room for him and to go through the bureaucracy of getting him there. I mean, it always amazes me. You know, we have a pretty good medical system in Canada. I do a lot of skiing still. You know, my knees are getting a bit creaky. If I wanted a new knee, I might be able to get one in 6 months. You know, I know a lot of doctors. I might be able to pull some strings and get one in a month. But it took me, you know, 9 years to find a place for Walker.
Mm.
I mean, I sometimes think about that and, you know, wonder what priorities it is that we live by. So finding it was difficult. Johanna, of course, his mum, you know, she wouldn't hear of it. For 8 years, I looked in secret. I would say, well, you know, maybe we should think about finding a place now for Walker. They say it's better to ease him into it rather than drop him into it when we're too old to, mm-hmm. you know, to do it properly. She said, oh, but I can't think about that now. So I did that secretly for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But the funny thing is, and, you know, group homes, we call them group homes in Canada. I think community homes is a much better phrase for it.
Mm.
But, you know, they have a terrible reputation in Canada because for a long time you couldn't get your kid into one without signing away your rights as a parent.
Mm.
It was just a holdover from the era before medical technology saved these
yes,
children.
Yes.
You know, I mean, everything has changed since that development. There was a lot of stigma, negative stigma attached to it. But and there is still a lot of stigma attached to putting human beings, children or adults, into these homes, because the fantasy, the orthodoxy is, well, of course, you must look after them yourselves. You must be able to do that. If you can't look after your children, never mind that they require 24-hour care from four people. If you can't look after, it's a sort of biblical thing, pre-biblical thing. If you can't look after your own, that's a failure. So there's this terrible stigma. But the weird thing is that when we actually put Walker into a home, and he lives there, he spends probably 7 days there and then comes home to us for 3 days and then goes back there for another 10 days, then back to us for three. But when we finally put him in there, this change overcame him. His confidence just skyrocketed instantly. When I first took him to a school that was dedicated to children like him, he had to be carried from room to room. Within 2 weeks of him going there, he was walking on his own. He developed this kind of, we used to call it his Schwarzenegger stagger. It sounds like he was walking into the room with some advanced machine gun.
And what do you put that down to? Was that just simply the confidence of being around others, you know, kind of finding a little flock of birds that he's a part of?
Not just that he's a part of. I think it's discovering that with us, he was the only person who couldn't do everything. When he's with people like himself, he sees that there are gradations and subtleties. There are people, you know, than whom he is more capable. Then there are people he's not as capable as. I mean, when he's with people who are like him, he realizes that he has strengths and weaknesses.
Okay. Yeah, there you are. Wow. That's really quite profound. And I'd imagine that the whole idea of you and your wife now getting some sleep would mean that you'd be in a lot better capacity to really give him some quality care when you do see him for those 3 days anyway. It must be an incredible burden for people to feel that if they can't look after their intellectually disabled, physically disabled, high needs child 24 hours around the clock, that they're in some way a failure. I mean, that would just be overwhelmingly difficult to deal with on top of the very need itself of actually looking after your child. Just before we let you go, for those parents who are listening who actually have maybe even just discovered that they have a special needs child, maybe of the same kind of degree of difficulty and effort that you've actually faced with Walker, I mean, what's some wisdom you can pass on to them in terms of, you know, just clearing the decks for the path ahead?
Well, I wish I had some, but there's two things I'd say. One is, you know, use the internet, because the internet has connected communities. You know, there were 8 children who had this syndrome when Walker was born. Today, there's a community of about 150. Mm-hmm. Those people connected up and compared notes and passed along research and attempted new diagnoses and new treatments only because of the internet. You know, before, that would never have happened. So that's one thing. But the other one is, the great thing Walker has taught me is that I don't have to live by adopted standards, that I don't have to live by the orthodoxies of my time. I can actually, you know, because he couldn't do so many things, we got to determine on our own, him, me, his mother, his sister, you know, together, we got to figure out what was important on our own standard. Mm-hmm. For Haley, his sister, who's a, you know, very graceful young woman, you know, to come in and dance with Walker in the living room for 20 seconds, you know, when she's not planning, you know, her social life or doing the many things teenagers have to do, that puts Walker on the moon, for just puts him right up there. Now, I mean, that's a standard behavior in a so-called normal family. In our family, I know how valuable that 20 seconds is, and it's really valuable. But to get to that point, you have to stop making. I had to stop making Walker, trying to make him into the boy I thought he was supposed to be, and I had to accept him as the boy he was, and stop blaming myself for the fact, or him for the fact that he wasn't.
Yeah.
After that, it gets a bit clearer.
Yeah. All right, Ian. Well, thank you for joining us on Open House tonight. It's been good to talk to you.
Well, a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Ian Brown, author, editor, TV anchor, award-winning journalist and author of this book, The Boy in the Moon. It's chronicling the joys and the sorrows and the suffering, the challenges and the lessons, indeed, of looking after 14-year-old Walker now with orphan syndrome. Look forward to your comments, 1-300-40-2020.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.